Welcome to Pop Unlock. I'm Landry Ayers. Joining me to count down the top 10 greatest Huey Lewis and the News albums and dive deep into the twisted mind of Patrick Bateman, American Psycho, are senior fellow at the Cato Institute, Julian Sanchez.
Landry, hey, let's get lunch.
And associate editor at Reason, Liz Wolf.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So glad to have you both here, especially to talk about a film that is as kind of complex and odd as American Psycho. Specifically, when you think about where it came from as a novel by Bret Easton Ellis, and then what it became as a film, and really what it's become after that in its legacy in internet culture. So the book itself was really called out as being highly misogynistic and hyper-violent, and there were calls for boycotts of it from all of these people. And it's a very graphic book in and of itself. I don't think you can deny that. It's even said that apparently when they were making the movie and there was talk of Leonardo DiCaprio getting to be cast as Patrick Bateman, that Gloria Steinem herself had to kind of help convince him that it would ruin his image with his younger female fans, and tried to convince him not to take it. But eventually they land on Christian Bale. And it's really interesting because both the script was written and adapted, and it was directed by women as well. And it really takes on a new form in the visual medium and becomes, I think, a lot more about a pointed depiction of masculinity at a certain point in time. Is this movie a feminist film in that way? Yes or no? And why? What's your take on that?
I mean, the thing that I keep coming back to is not the degree to which it is or is not a feminist film, because to some degree, I like the restraint that the director exercised in terms of understanding which pieces to excise from the book and use, and how to use them in a way that is still a decent and pleasant-ish viewing experience. I think had she had more fidelity to the book, it would have been, you know, terribly graphic, terribly uncomfortable to watch. It would have sort of seeped into the obvious explicit horror category, and you might have lost some of the satirical elements. So I appreciate the restraint to some degree. But the thing I keep coming back to is how interesting it is to consider this sort of like metrosexual, like ultra like vain dudescaping, manscaping type attitude. Because one of the things that I think people sometimes talk about nowadays is, you know, they sort of pretend we're in a new fresh wave of like TikTokified dude hair, dudes caring a lot about their personal care and hygiene routines. Men are being more freely vain. But we did have this whole wave in the 80s. So this isn't exactly a thing that's limited to 2022 or 2021 or something that happened with the advent of social media. This is something that really existed 40-ish years ago. And so I really like the degree to which American Psycho brings you back to that time and reminds a modern day viewer that this is not a new or recent phenomenon.
So I'd say, I'll just second that. I reread the book for the first time in probably 20 years in preparation for the podcast, and I had, I guess, maybe blotted out. Right, the movie, you know, kind of keeps itself firmly sort of in the realm of black comedy by keeping most of Bateman's actual killing sort of off screen. You see the blood splash on his face, or the, you know, from a distance, a body with a chainsaw in it. But it manages to sort of still play, for the most part, darkly funny. The book has these really lengthy, nauseating descriptions of just graphic sexual violence that just, you know, drag on past the point anyone, you know, could conceivably find it funny that, you know, I wouldn't be extremely worried about, so psychologically. I don't think it could have been filmed or released, if they'd actually included that. It makes The Human Centipede look like a Disney film, or would have if they'd filmed that. But yeah, to Liz's point, I think one of the interesting things, again, this maybe comes a little bit more in the book, is, you know, I mean, the book, you really are a third of the way through before you actually get scenes where Bateman is like actually killing anyone. There are kind of increasing references to maybe he's got these impulses. But for a very long, you know, stretch of it, it is, it is him kind of tediously, meticulously describing every article of clothing that everyone's wearing and every appliance and all the, you know, exactly what brand of moisturizer he uses and where the tie is from and where the pocket square is from. And, you know, this is coupled with, again, a little more in the book, right? Bateman's and his whole social circle's incredibly intense homophobia. You get a little bit of this in the movie. They use the F, not that F word, the homophobic slur F word, a fair amount. It comes up a lot more in the book along with racial slurs. And, you know, there's an interesting tension there, right? You've got this sort of stereotypically, you know, kind of 80s stereotypically gay, right? Kind of hyper interest in, right, sort of sartorial concerns and the fine points of dressing elegantly and correctly and working out. And, you know, you get this in the film, right? Kind of Bateman's sort of narcissistic obsession with his own sort of Adonis-like physical perfection. And then almost maybe as a kind of a reaction to that, right, really intense homophobia. You get this in the film a little bit. He reacts with right obvious kind of horror when Lewis Carruthers sort of mistakes his, you know, incipient strangling as a sexual overture. And obviously Bateman is kind of disgusted and revolts against that. That gets stretched out a lot more in the book. And there's a weird tension there because, he's doing something with that, because of course, right, he's overtly reacting in this kind of revolted, and hostile way. But right, Carruthers doesn't actually get killed in the book, as I recall, right? In fact, I think it's the fact that violence is eroticized for Bateman, right? The fact that again, much more clearly in the book, that he is right sexually aroused by the violence he inflicts, right, creates this situation where right he backs off an attempt to kill Carruthers, precisely because I think he's anxious about right recognizing what it might mean for him to experience right sort of the arousal of that murder in a context where, in some sense, right, the victim is a man who is attracted to him. So that's something that's, I just, you know, it's a 90-minute movie. So there's just a lot of that doesn't make it in the same level of detail.
So this is, I think, actually a huge weakness of the movie. The fact that the connection between the eroticism he feels from violence, I don't get that in the movie to nearly the degree that I would have expected. Do you guys get that? Like, to some degree, the thing that keeps, that they do a really good job underscoring and highlighting is that that Bateman is so detached from getting any sort of sexual gratification from women. You know, he obviously sees them as objects. He has porn on in the background while he's doing like routine chores and errands and stuff like that. You know, making a dinner reservation, there's just like porn playing the way that like I would maybe put on like a cooking show or something like that, or a beauty tutorial, you know, but for him, it's porn. But I don't get the connection in the movie between eroticism and violence as it's sort of in portrayed in Bateman's mind. Do you get that in the movie?
I really don't. I'm not sure where it gets. And to me, what's interesting is he talks about these compulsions that are constantly sort of, you know, creating this inhuman need for him to enact violence on all of these people. And you sort of get the idea that and he says, like, I've confessed to killing like 20 people and, you know, this might have happened before. And he's had these compulsions for a long time, but only recently are they being forced out into his real life. But you kind of get the idea that he's, you know, well planned enough that he's probably enacted this type of thing before. But the release he does get from it becomes less and less over time. But I don't know if that comes from the act itself, you know, not functioning in the same way, or if it's that he gets sloppy in the way that he does it and he gets closer and closer to getting caught doing it by someone like Willem Dafoe's character. And that is, he comes to this, you know, fear-fueled confession when he finally calls his lawyer on the phone after he's gone on this crazy killing spree out of nowhere, and he begins to, like, you know, break down emotionally. And it's, you know, one of the few times in the film beyond just rage that we're getting a lot of emoting from this character. And you wonder for a brief moment where this is coming from and what it's going to, and then you realize that it's simply a fear of getting caught, not a fear of being inhuman and realizing any sort of thing about himself. He doesn't undergo like a significant internal change at that moment. There's no like...
There is no catharsis. Sort of, there's nothing to...
Exactly. There's no the catharsis telling. There. It's only I'm about to get caught. And the guilt says, like, that is where it comes from. So the sort of lack of any type of gratification from this, it's true. It's sort of complicated, but maybe that lends into the sort of dissatisfaction that he feels at the end of the film. I can't speak to the ending of the book, but maybe that disconnect where we assume there to be a gratification, really the it being absent is trying to illustrate the meaninglessness of it all and the sort of flaw in what could be seen as delusions, but I think a lot of people take as, you know, something he has actually enacted on these people.
The movie, much more than the book, right, kind of leans into this idea of ambiguity about how much of this violence he's carried out is, you know, some kind of hallucinatory fantasy. There's a little bit of that in the book, but it's less. The way the movie is structured, right? All of the elements that seem like, you know, we're getting Bateman's unreliable narration. We're seeing through his eyes stuff that probably does not literally happen exactly as it's depicted, is sort of bunched together at the end. In a way that, you know, it's not that none of this happens in the book, it's that they are compressed as the final moments, or the, you know, the final like 20 minutes, in a way that much more strongly biased towards a sort of suggestion that, oh, maybe this is all in his head. That's much less strongly suggested in the book. In the book, I think the stronger implication is that, well, yes, he's an unreliable narrator, but that that in a sense, right, the society around him is so psychopathic that he is in fact kind of normal, that it will not allow him to be caught, because, well, he's this wealthy, attractive, you know, outwardly conforming, you know, rich white guy. And so even when he tries to openly confess, they sort of don't recognize him as this monster that he is. One of the interesting scenes that in the movie, I think, leans more into this, again, the ambiguity about whether he's really done it, is he goes to visit the apartment where he's killed Paul Allen in the movie, Owen in the book, and a couple of other sex workers there, you know, at least that we've seen on screen. And everything is sort of cleaned up and repainted, and there's a realtor showing the place, and it's sort of a little bit tense. And it leans a little heavier in the movie into the potential interpretation that, like, this was never Paul's apartment, that none of that really happened. In the book, the clearer implication is this is a multi-million-dollar condo, right, that needs to be resold. And so the people who own this and stand to make money off it are not about to report a bunch of gruesomely dismembered bodies in this apartment. So this has all been covered up because, well, look, we got to, you know, we can't tank the property value of this luxury condo. And so in a sense, right, it's about the networks of protection around, which is, you know, in its own way, pretty timely, right? Right. The way, these sort of institutions of wealth and power act to protect, even people who are increasingly obviously and openly depraved. You know, you could pick your favorite example from the contemporary headlines.
You see that from the broker who's present in the movie scene where he goes back to Paul Allen's apartment And she sort of responds with this very vague, difficult to sort of discern and suss out, not exactly a sense of suspicion, a sense of guardedness. She sort of seems to be aware of the history of what happened in that apartment and knows that somebody who is also aware of that is absolutely somebody that she wants to get as far away as possible from that situation, because it jeopardizes her bottom line. It threatens the ability of the people, the stakeholders, to basically rehabilitate this apartment and get it sold again or rented again. And so I think that scene is really interesting, because it's almost like, I think that it lends some credence to the idea that these things actually did happen in reality and not just in Bateman's head, because there's a sense of like acknowledgement from her. And I don't know, I don't know what to make of her guardedness, if not that. But one thing I also think about a lot that really, I hadn't considered it upon my first or second watch of the movie, but the rewatch, is the degree to which Bateman's like almost archival work is really impressive and bizarre. The degree to which he has these like drawings of the woman that he slaughters and the brutal ways that he kills them. And he has these like very brutal depictions. He almost never focuses on the sexual side of things. There's definitely, you know, very graphic, detailed sketches of their bodies. But more than anything, it's focused on the weapon that's used. You know, it's not about the boobs. It's about the chainsaw. But then you also see, I mean, the degree to which he can sort of very easily in his confession rattle off all the different crimes he's committed. He almost keeps these things very front of mind. He's also doing the archival work of recording himself having sex with these people before he kills them, and sometimes also recording the killings. So that's the thing that I really found fascinating upon rewatch, the degree to which he's almost obsessive, because it all goes into this idea of like he cares so much about the image he's constructed of himself, and there's such a strain of vanity throughout all of this. But it's like these crimes would be less meaningful to him and less fulfilling to him, to the extent that they even are fulfilling, if they weren't so heavily documented, and if he didn't have these means of sort of like listing them out and compiling them and feeling some sense of accumulation. And there's just an interesting detail present in how he documents this. You would almost think that a more savvy killer would be interested in covering their tracks, whereas he's almost interested in making it clear that, you know, he remembers every single little detail of each of these different encounters. Which I think is part of like that detail is what makes American Psycho different than other things that could perhaps be loosely fit into this genre.
Right. It doesn't seem like if you saw this film and the killings absent of Patrick Bateman's life outside, you could kind of get the impression that he's a serial killer and he's collecting trophies. You know, it's like some people take, you know, fingers from their victims, or, you know, it's Dexter Morgan's blood slides or whatever.
He has the lock of hair in one of his that he's fiddling with right at work. The blonde hair, always blonde.
And you could see that it could just be like a trophy collection type of thing. But when that is placed in the context of Patrick Bateman and this sort of consumerist, yuppie satire, it becomes much more than I get a fulfillment from being reminded that I kill people. It is that fulfillment is derived from a list, a collection of things that are more associated with labels and esteem rather than just a sort of collection of trinkets. It's much more of something that he is proud of rather than just feels like he talks about his compulsive needs, but the trophies he collects and the archiving, which I think is a really great way of putting it because it's so organized and is this sort of record of the acts, it creates more of a story for him, which a lot of serial killers in the sort of depictions that we get, they do sometimes get depicted as doing this for esteem. And, you know, they eventually confess and, you know, want people to know all of the people that they've done. But in the consumerist label sort of routine-driven world of American Psycho, he stands out, and maybe it is more a sort of satire on that type of thing and equating it with the serial killer type collecting compulsion rather than comparing Patrick Bateman to the serial killer. It's sort of moving in the opposite direction and drawing our eyes in a new way.
Well, you see, I mean, you get a connection between his sort of status anxiety and the murders in both the book and the film. Right, he first moves to kill Carruthers, though he doesn't actually do it. When he realizes Carruthers has a much better business card than he does, and this right enrages him. There's a murder that he confesses to in the film that we don't see on screen, that we do get at length in the book, where he kills an ex-girlfriend from Harvard. And it's right after she's come to his apartment. He's got this painting that he's David and I, someone that he's very proud of, on the wall. And she realizes that he's hung it upside down. And she sort of giggles a little bit. And that's when he, hits her in the head with a nail gun. So a lot of his violence in both of them, right, seems to immediately follow some kind of right perceived humiliation or something that's sort of thrown his sense of status into question.
Well, the thing that I find really sort of baffling still is which women get targets on their backs versus which don't in Bateman world or in Bateman's mind. Because I think you could almost line them up to be a high status, low status thing, where Evelyn and Courtney and these women who are in his milieu aren't ever threatened in the same way that other women are. But then, a prostitute that he finds on the street is somebody who ends up killed, or he's constantly sort of killing prostitutes. He sees a secretary as somebody that he can feasibly, plausibly do all this with. But then the one thing that really does scramble this is Elizabeth, I think is her name, the brunette acquaintance of his who sort of runs in his same circles, who he has the threesome with, Christy, the prostitute, and Elizabeth. And he kills Elizabeth first and then is angling to kill Christy, and she ends up almost successfully escaping. But that's the thing that really scrambles it for me, of like Elizabeth would be the type of person who would be sort of seen in a cohort with Evelyn and Courtney and those types. And so I sort of don't know what to make of that status pursuit in terms of his victims. What do you guys think there?
I mean, it does seem like there's a kind of escalation where, most of his targets are lower status. And right, there's an element of kind of class humiliation that sort of precedes the physical sadism, where he kind of goes out of his way to talk about where he worked and his fancy job, and he's asking the prostitute he picked up on the street, where'd you go to college? And there's in the scene with Elizabeth, she's saying, oh, where do you summer? Is it the Hamptons? And there's obviously a whole element of, obviously she didn't go to college, doesn't summer anywhere, doesn't have a context.
She's obviously a North Fork girl.
Right, yes, obviously. but right, it just seemed to escalate over the course of it, where he is right gradually ascending to right victims closer to his own sort of socioeconomic status and class status. Although, in the book, the first sort of indication of his tendencies is that his fiance's neighbor has been decapitated, and he kind of offhandedly kind of essentially references, oh yeah, that, I did that, and then kind of moves on, and it's actually quite a while before we get back to him being a murderer. But it is it's something in the book, at least, where actually one of the first murders that we're kind of conscious of him having committed is someone who, lives next door to his fiancée and is presumably also someone, right, wealthy enough to be living next door to someone in that income bracket.
It's also really interesting that, and I noticed this as I was watching, that there are several moments in the film, and I think they're almost exclusively when he's talking to women. I might be wrong about that, but I think it's the case where he, in a normal conversation in a public place, when he would normally be very guarded and trying to not describe his acts or anything like that, he will flat out tell people about his compulsions for violence and what he does. Like, they're at the nightclub one night, and one of the women over all of the music asks what he does. And part of this is he's probably feels like he can get away with it because there's all the loud music playing and she can't really hear him. But she says, "What do you do?" And he says, "I work in murders and executions." And she hears mergers and acquisitions and asks him if he likes it, because all the people she knows that works in that hate it. And there, it's this weird, like, she doesn't even, she's not fazed by it. But then later on, he's on the phone with his secretary and he's trying to tell her what he's like. "I'll," I think he says either "I'll kill you." He's, you know, because she's questioning him, or she's like, he's like, "I've killed a bunch of people." It is a blatant confession. And she just goes, "What's that? I can't hear you." And then later on, when he's breaking up with Evelyn at the restaurant, he is describing his compulsions for, he says, "I have these homicidal tendencies that I cannot let go." And she is so in her own world that she's being broken up with, that that sort of impact does not even faze her at all. And I was really kind of taken aback by that, because it's weird, because he takes such like pride in the work, but is also so guarded about it with certain people. But perhaps it's that status anxiety and the way that he escalates and sort of differentiates his victims, that he feels like there's some people that he can be honest with. And maybe it's perhaps because he doesn't feel threatened by those types of people, and it's a way of sort of exerting his own power on them.
And the most transgressive part of that scene, which I, the one where he breaks up with Evelyn, is not even that he is sort of quietly admitting to some of these things while she ignores him. The most transgressive part is that he's using a crayon or a colored pencil to color on the table. And he's coloring, you know, stuff about his most recent execution. I think it might have been a chainsaw situation. But it's not even the fact that there's a chainsaw there. It's the fact that he is coloring on the table at this presumably very high status restaurant. Like, that's the thing that really should be most striking about the entire thing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is conspicuous is sort of how little he seems to care about getting caught. And I mean, that's in a sense, right? I think this is the satirical point, right, which is he doesn't really have to hide it. He gets there's a great scene that actually I don't think is in the book, where he runs into Carruthers while he's dragging these sort of blood soaked sleeping bag or garment bag with one of his victims in it, and like loading it into the trunk of a car. And Carruthers walks by and looks at what he's kind of dumping in the bag. He's obviously packed with a body in it. And he says, "Ooh, where'd you get that garment bag?" And, you know, and he's, Jean-Paul Gaultier, slams it and jumps into the car and goes off. So he's kind of throughout just sort of increasingly open about what he's doing. And it's just sort of never believed or recognized. In a lot of ways, this is a kind of a magical realist book and film in that sense, in that you have these sort of horrific in one sense fantastical in the sense of just being wildly outside of kind of any kind of normal reality, juxtaposed with these sort of incredibly mundane, you know, catalogs of brands and details of couture, and no one sort of ever bats an eyelash, even as it just becomes increasingly overt that he's a psychopath, and it's okay, he fits right in. That's what he says in both book and film, right? "Why do you, you know, your family is so rich, why do you even bother with this job?" I want to fit in. And of course he does.
Speaking of things that in the, you know, when this movie was released and in the world of it that people don't bat an eyelash at, they kind of take for granted, but looking back on it now might jump out and mean a lot more to us than when this film was made, is the inclusion of the Donald Trump idea in this movie, and the idolatrous sort of worship of Trump that is even heavier in the book, but is still very, very present in the movie. The sort of always looking at a different table and saying, is that Ivana? Is that Donald? He changes an opinion about a restaurant because he hears that Trump actually really, really likes it. And his favorite book is Art of the Deal. Are Patrick Bateman types or people maybe that saw American Psycho, like, I don't want to, you know, overstate this, but are they partially to blame for Trump 2016? You know, while the film might have not changed it so much, is there this sort of collective idea of what Trump was at that time that has morphed and changed and became The Apprentice and then the man who ran and won the presidency? And how did we get from American Psycho Donald Trump to the American Psycho Donald Trump?
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting because it's clearly, right, in a sense, right, pre-political, right? So this is a book that comes out in 91 or 92, the film that comes out in 2000, when Donald Trump is a liberal Democrat. So, right, it's not like, oh, he's being held up as a bad guy because, like, liberal Hollywood doesn't like a conservative Republican. But nevertheless, so that's not what, you know, what's motivating this. And yet, you know, when you want to show that someone is a soulless a sociopath with no redeeming qualities, how do you show? Well, you show that his personal hero and role model is Donald Trump. So even with, right, kind of the political political valence is sort of inverted. You know, the understanding for Ellis and his readers, and I guess the viewer of the film, is supposed to be, well, my gosh, you know, you would have to be a really depraved person for Donald Trump to be your personal hero, which is, right, one of those interesting things about his kind of political ascendancy is that in, like, his own milieu, New York and folks who are interested in things happening in New York, right, Trump was sort of regarded with this degree of kind of horror and contempt long before he, right, had any kind of political identity that was, you know, beyond being a friend of the Clintons.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of compare this, I agree with all of that, and I compare this a little bit to the first few episodes of Sex and the City, where Samantha, the character in Sex and the City, tells Carrie, when introducing Mr. Big, basically, to the audience, he's like the next Donald Trump, except younger and better looking. And that, when you watch that today, it has a completely different meaning. But back then, it's useful, especially for me. Like, I am much younger. I am, like, on the very young end of millennial. And it's useful to contextualize, like, what the 1990s image of Trump was within these certain social sets. Because it was sort of, I think, to some degree, an aspirational, it conveyed a sense of machismo. There was some amount of aspirational wealth, clout that came with that. There wasn't a sense of, oh, this person is so objectionable and there are all these political attachments there, so much as it was like, this guy is uber well connected, top of his game. And a lot of men in a lot of different industries, I think, aspired to be like that. He had this, I guess, transcendent quality, despite being a real estate magnate, where all the Wall Street bros, the financial dudes, were interested in emulating that and sort of saw him as aspirational, even though he wasn't quite as explicitly within their industry or somebody who had risen through the ranks of their specific vertical, he was still sort of seen as the almost like status reaching everyman, the everyman of the elite, in a sense. And I think you see that in Sex and the City, you see that in American Psycho. And it's funny because I wonder how many modern viewers see the Donald Trump references in American Psycho and take that sort of mental shortcut of being like, oh yeah, the director's saying like Donald Trump bad and Bateman bad and everybody's a psychopath. And it's like, well, that doesn't make sense. Like, that's pretty anachronistic if you actually think about it for more than 3 seconds. But I wonder to what degree the film holds up better because of people's sort of mental laziness and ability to take those shortcuts.
It's interesting, too, because Patrick Bateman and especially the Trump election and presidency both kind of came, Patrick Bateman as an internet meme really, really took off at a similar time as the sort of Sigma grind set, like work hard, you know, elite, top of your game type of like semi-satirical, but not always, mindset was beginning to launch. And then you have the Trump presidency and that the sort of very, very heavy grassroots digital movement that went on to support him and try and swing the election in his direction with things like the Donald and all the memes and things that were spurred on by that. They kind of ascend in a similar way, and you can see how these ideas have always kind of been in conversation with one another. But in a way, the memification of Patrick Bateman, I wonder, does it miss something? Does it not make that connection? Like, and I think you could make a lot of arguments that some people are doing this for satirical purposes, and they're trying to say, you know, they're using Patrick Bateman to use these ideas and further them to call attention to something. But a lot of people, I think, use that image in a non-ironic sense and don't really understand the significance of what that image and character can and really represent. And it kind of muddles the meaning with that. Do we risk, by sort of memifying him, turning him into just another kind of Gordon Gekko, Jordan Belfort from Wolf of Wall Street, hyper-masculine hero that people misunderstand, kind of like does it have Fight Club syndrome in that way?
I mean, one thing that I think is that the memification of Bateman himself definitely does run that risk. But memification of specific components of American Psycho, I find to be absolutely delightful. Like the business card scene, which is so iconic. And also, at this point, becoming a little bit of a relic of the past, because like, do people still have business cards? Maybe that's just because I'm a journalist, so I'm like, look me up on Twitter. But the best one that I've seen is it's all about poking fun at corporate culture and the sort of evolving mores there, but it's like the Paul Allen business card, and then it says like he/him on it, and sort of the absurdity of how that would like not in any way land, you know, the joke is that would not in any way land in that type of corporate culture, but now that's like a thing that you see as much more pervasive and seen as, you know, that type of signaling about people's pronouns is seen as not only something that is accepted in those types of circles, but something that I think people kind of do to signal their virtue and to get ahead in a lot of those environments, because that's seen as valuable in a way that it didn't used to be. I don't know. I mean, I think about like to such a high degree, all of this holds up. Like, we don't call them yuppies anymore, and they're not typically Wall Street bros. The sort of recession and financial crisis kind of ruined the creation of media about Wall Street types. But there's also like perhaps private equity culture or venture capitalist culture is the closest corollary that we have now. The whole Silicon Valley earlier stage startup tech bro hustle culture doesn't map well onto this because it grapples with status and hierarchy in a different way. And at least in the earlier stages of creating businesses within Silicon Valley, there is so much more emphasis on actually putting in the time and doing the work before you can begin to reap the status rewards. And so in a sense, it's not quite as cushy as you graduate from a top tier school, you get hired by one of these firms, and then you're 26 or you're 27 years old, like a lot of these people, and you're in it. You have your Valentino suit and you have your Jean-Paul Gaultier body bag or suit bag or whatever. It almost like seems more like what I've seen people from elite schools do when they go into consulting. But Silicon Valley, at least, you know, the parts of it that are really respected do continue to have this actual barrier to entry, which is you have to actually be good at what you do. You have to have technical skill in a lot of situations, especially if you want to be ground level at a lot of these startups. Maybe later on, I think private equity culture might be the appropriate sort of modern day corollary, but I think to some degree, Bateman will be somewhat inoculated from being as memified because there's not as clear of a current equivalent.
So, one of the things that interests me about this is when you can put it in the context of other, you know, sort of, I guess, Wall Street satires or critiques, is how much this film doesn't directly really have a lot to say about capitalism in contrast to those other works. In the book, actually, I don't think it says Gordon, but there is an offhand throwaway reference to, oh, what happened to Gecko. So it's implying that, like, Gordon Gecko is a character in this fictional world who has maybe suffered some kind of comeuppance for financial crimes. But right, those are the reasons, in a sense, right, have something to say about, and you know, we're all right libertarians here and generally pretty pro capitalism, but you know, they all have a critique that is to some extent about, you know, the structures of capitalism itself, and you know how the artist perceives it as whatever, taking advantage of people or being based on, you know, so scams and trickery or whatever. And that's almost entirely absent here, right? There's a critique of the kind of level of character and culture, right? These are shallow, sort of insipid, banal people who, you know, look down on and or have no compassion for the homeless and the less fortunate, and feel superior, though they don't really in any recognizable way deserve to feel that way or you know, have any kind of greater personal merit. But like the sort of meat of like what Bateman actually does with his work is just not part of the story at all, right? It is not a story about, in a sense, right, like Wall Street finance itself being a kind of hostile, right, some kind of destructive force. You hear almost nothing about, he's really interested in the Fisher account that Paul Allen has, but that's, you know, as far as you can tell, all he actually does at his desk is like read Sports Illustrated and make, you know, homicidal doodles, which is yeah, I don't know. Look, it's not that I feel like, oh, I really needed to read another English major's critique of capitalism, but it is interesting to me that the in a way that's almost you know, maybe a little bit Bateman-like, the sort of contempt is at this very cultural level, right? Like, you know, Patrick Bateman is this, you know how you know he's bad? He likes Donald Trump, and also, right, his only kind of cultural passion is for, like, really insipid kind of super mainstream, right? Like, the most kind of mass market, mass culture. He's really into like Genesis and Whitney Houston and Huey Lewis, and he even thinks in the book, right, God, that Huey Lewis is superior to Elvis Costello, which, God, what kind of Philistine idiot would think that, which, you know, of course, right, that is a crazy view. Of course Elvis Costello is better than Huey Lewis, but how much the sort of the satire and the contempt is, in a sense, really lacks any kind of coherent statement about why, you know, at a structural level, I think Wall Street firms are bad and exploitative because XYZ, and is much more centered on, I find these sort of people repellent at a kind of cultural level.
I think to some degree, it means that like one thing that was really striking to me as a New Yorker, who has too many sort of vaguely yuppie-ish friends, is like the degree to which so much of this goddamn like dinner reservation rat race is still absolutely totally a thing. Like, I put this in one of our exchanges before this of like, I feel like I've been to Dorsia, so to speak. In the sense of, like, to me, you know, an Indian meal in Jackson Heights is just as good as the fanciest thing that everybody's raving about in Manhattan. But for whatever reason, there's like a whole set of people, and I think it transcends industry to some degree. I see it reflected in friends who are high earners in a whole bunch of different fields, where there's just this interest in doing this thing to be able to talk. It's, I guess, a means of connecting with other people. You know, did you try the squid at Dorsia? Oh, we tried the squid ravioli there, whatever. And it's relatable to some degree because I'm such a food person, but there is just this component that's like, I almost wonder, this like rich person, New York status game, will this ever feel out of date? You know, this is set in the 80s. I still feel like some people that I know play this game and talk in this manner in 2022. I mean, in 2060, will this continue to be the way that like muddied New York high society type stuff works? Not that I don't want to oversell the degree to which I'm a part of that, but I do know a few people who are, you know, very much like that. And, you know, I oftentimes will try out a restaurant with them, you know, every once in a while. And I'm just sort of constantly annoyed by how overrated a lot of these places are. I think perhaps because I'm not getting the social capital benefit from talking about it the way that they are. They go to work at a fancy law firm and they say, oh, I got a reservation at this place and we tried this dish there. Whereas I'm just like a freaking writer who tweets too much. And so if I say, you know, I got a reservation at this fancy place, I don't think it means that much to the people that I'm trying to impress. And I think I kind of prefer my group because of that reason. A samosa that you get in Jackson Heights is just as valuable.
Well, yeah, obviously, if they remade it, Bateman would be Instagramming all his appetizers.
Well, that was an interesting part of the opening sequence, like the degree to which it's not blood, it's plating, you know, that we're seeing with the red liquid that's being used. And then I don't know if you guys caught this in the credits also, business card font for all of them. Yeah, which I thought was just a fascinating way of just continuing to like underscore these points about this is fundamentally a critique of upper crust people, not any of the deeper things beneath that.
Although, you know, one of the things I've seen Ellis sort of admit in interviews is that there is a somewhat kind of confessional element to this, not in that Ellis is admitting to a series of murders, but that, right, look, I mean, this, again, maybe this comes out more clearly in the book, but like, Ellis is clearly intimately familiar with all of these brands. And, you know, some of the restaurants are made up and some of them are real. And I think what he, you know, what he said in interviews is, look, you know, this is a satire and a critique, but it's a critique of something that he is not totally unfamiliar with. That in fact, he you know, is actually quite well acquainted with, you know, Etro and Versace and Manolo Blahnik and all these things, and has, you know, in him, you know, recognizes in himself some of that sort of desire to kind of elevate himself through you know, kind of identification with brands and to be recognized as, you know, someone tasteful. And
he threw his dad under the bus at first when the book first came out. Apparently, people were asking him what he's based on. He's like, "Oh, my dad, he's a real monster." And then only until recent years was he like, "Actually, I was just kind of embarrassed." And so it's actually much more based on my life during a certain period of time when I was like going through and living a life very similar to Patrick Bateman, not in the killing sense, but in this sort of like consumerist, consuming, status anxiety driven sense.
I mean, looked at one way, these restaurant names and these brands, these fashion brands, and the names of different people who are working on different projects, like looked at one way, it's shorthand for constructing a personality or for attempting to convey that you have a personality to people. And I think there's a really dark side to that. There's a laziness that springs from that. And we see a lot of those themes touched on in American Psycho. But also looked at another way, and I hate to like be this like constant capitalist shill, but I am one. You know, it's kind of cool and interesting and maybe valuable that people who perhaps cannot or won't develop a personality in other ways are able to transact money that they earned to feel like they have the trappings of a personality and to feel like they're able to, I don't know, I imagine this is a way that people rise in the ranks of status and class where, you know, perhaps they were born to a much poorer family, but they need to relate to certain people within a certain professional setting. And so one of the ways that you signal your belongingness is by saying, hey, I got a reservation here, or that food that you're talking about, I know about that as well. And so to some degree, it's a means of people, it's a means for people to climb into classes that they weren't born in, and to use these really sort of easy shorthand ways to signal that they're part of something that they're perhaps not naturally part of. I think that's a really cool thing. You can sort of use it for good or for evil.
Look, you know, I'm you know, sympathetic. Look, I like a nice Etro suit as much as the next guy. Probably more than the next guy. So I don't meticulously obsess in the same way over every, aspect of that. But I think, you know, it to some extent, right, lands a satire because probably a lot of the audience, right, you know, gets to feel superior to Bateman, because, well, because they're not serial killers and because, and you know, huge racists, but, you know, because it's not to the same extent. But it lands to the extent that I think we look at this and probably, you know, I guess if we're from the kind of class that's reading Bret Easton Ellis novels, recognize a little bit of that, like, oh, you know what, I do like, you know, finding a nice suit and saying, gosh, you know, I like how this looks, and I hope people notice that it's it's something fancy. As long as we, you know, just have to not mistake that for a personality.
Yeah, as a person who worked at a Joseph A. Bank for 3 years in college, I do recognize a quality suit when I see one, because I stared at so many that weren't for that long. not a sponsor of the show and won't be in the future.
I gotta say, one of my favorite blazers that I wear all the time is a tweed Joseph Bank blazer.
The blazers are different. They do something with the blazers. The suits
perfectly
will fall
nice
apart.
Garment. I'll yes. buy it. I'm just saying.
I still have one in the closet.
I own garments from Joseph A. Bank that I like a lot. I have no shame in that.
I'm sure you bought two and got 19 free.
Come well, yeah, look, it doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt that you get two for one. Seriously, no, come for me, Bateman. I no shame in my Joseph A. Bank jacket.
Thanks for listening. As always, the best way to get more Pop and Lock content is to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at the handle @PopandLockPod. That's Pop, the letter N, Lock, with an E like the philosopher, Pod. Make sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and please rate and review us if you like the show. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time. Pop and Lock is a project of libertarianism.org and is produced by me, Landry Ayers. To learn more, visit us on the web at libertarianism.org.